I can be proud to tell my daughters why I work at BP, whether I'm working in solar or oil or gas or carbon capture, because we are building the system that the world so desperately needs. And despite all the comments or the sometimes the negativity, this is a good thing. And I do believe the world is a better place with energy companies in it than without it.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. If this is your first time joining us, I'm the host, Simon Brewer. And in this show, we talk to proven leaders and thinkers from the worlds of business, investing, and beyond. We try to distill the thoughts of guests about their approach to mastering capital allocation, making better business and investment decisions, learning from mistakes, and strategies for taking your career to the next level. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter via moneymazepodcast.com. Episodes are also published on our YouTube channel, and we're active on all major social media platforms. Thank you for listening. If your CV tells a story, then earning a master's degree in physics, captaining your rugby team at Oxford, then a few years later being posted as BP's engineering manager to Baku, Azerbaijan, followed by country head to neighboring Georgia, COO of their solar subsidiary, and now head of oil wells, it begs the question, which is the grittier, those landscapes or our guest? So today in London, in a slightly more hospitable environment than she sometimes faces, Anne Davis, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you.
I'd like to go back a little bit to your youth and just ask you, what was the most important lesson you learnt growing up that you feel has helped your progression?
I grew up in northwest Wales by the seaside. And what's wonderful about growing up by the seaside is the horizon and the sky. And as a child, I used to enjoy looking out to space. I was really interested in astronomy and stars. And that bred curiosity very, very early on. And that ultimately bred my interest in science, in maths, the language of the universe. And I have retained that curiosity my entire life, which has led me to probably where I am today.
So is that the Anglesey connection, why you know Will Campion?
I'm actually from Gwynedd, which is close to Anglesey. Yes, but we do share a mutual love of northwest Wales.
Okay. So you go to Oxford to read physics, and of all the options on graduating, the energy industry is a notoriously male-dominated macho culture. Why BP?
Great question. So I loved studying physics, which is also very male-dominated. I think at the time, around 15% of the undergrads were female. But what I enjoyed about physics was not only just learning the language of the world and the universe and how everything works, but how we apply that to the real problems of today. And as I was approaching my master's year, I was getting closer to the engineering, the applied side of physics, and enjoying that even more so. And as I was thinking about careers, I mean, I could have stayed in academia. I was also looking at the financing sector, which is, we're keen on physicists because of the math we do. But engineering really, really appealed to me. And I'd done a couple of summer roles at the Ministry of Defence. And one of my colleagues' husband worked at BP. And she suggested, have you thought about BP or a company like BP who are involved in energy? And at the time, Lord Brown was at the helm, leading the energy transition. He'd done the Stanford speech, had taken BP to beyond petroleum. And that just really captured my imagination, because I can't think of another sector out there where you are serving the entire society of the world in terms of the need for energy, but also the complexities around geopolitics, politics, commercial, technical, engineering challenge was vast. And that just fed my curiosity. And that's why I got into energy. And that's why I joined BP.
Great. Well, we're going to talk about a number of those strands you mentioned. But firstly, a disclaimer, I own shares in BP, have done for several years. I'm also going to give a quick recap. Everybody thinks they know BP. But in fact, of course, origins date back to the Anglo-Persian Oil Company of 1909. In 1935, it became the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Went and bought Standard Oil of Ohio in 78, privatized between 79 and 87, merged with Amoco in 98, acquired Arco and Burma Castro in 2000, bought a stake in TNK BP, so earned 20% of Rosneft, and today he's got a market cap around $100 billion. I think it's the fifth largest UK-listed company and employs 67,000 people in 60 countries. I spared you having to tell us all that. Question I wasn't sure of, The shareholder split geographically, how does that shape out?
I think it's varied across the years, but we're broadly half US, half Europe, and some others.
I want to just go to those two postings. Not everybody gets the chance to go to Baku and Tbilisi. Of course, that was Georgia was the home to Joseph Stalin. What stands out from those experiences?
Oh, I loved both experiences and two countries next to each other, but also so quite different and culturally. But one thing that binds them certainly is the people and the desire of the people for prosperity and progress and care for one another and family. And I really, really enjoyed my time in both. I mean, Baku has gone through a massive transformation in the past 25 years. And much of our time as BP in Baku has been part of that transformation. I mean, much of the country's budget is set around how our oil field, ACG, performs. And that's a huge level of responsibility. So your integration with society and integration with the country is very, very high, especially as a guest, as an expat in the country. And then in Georgia, Georgia's a small country like Wales, around 3 million people. They love rugby like Wales. Oh, yes, they love a male voice choir as well. So I certainly felt at home in Georgia. Very strategically important. I mean, BP's been one of the largest investors in Georgia, around $2 billion. Because of the investment in the pipeline and infrastructure that goes through Georgia to oil pipelines and also a big gas pipeline, which was recently expanded as part of the Shah Deniz expansion project. This forms an important part of 3,500 kilometers worth of infrastructure, which brings gas from the Caspian through to the European Union, landing in Italy. So a very different kind of role to be head of country, because you need to look at everything in all different lenses and really think about what's important for the country that you're serving, as well as the business you're representing. And I certainly enjoyed that challenge and that opportunity.
So your new CEO, and I'm probably getting his surname pronounced incorrectly, Murray Auchincloss.
Auchincloss.
Auchincloss, very good Scottish name there, said that BP's mission is unchanged, transforming to an integrated energy company built on three pillars: resilience, convenience, low carbon energy, mobility. Now, the conundrum's clear. The conflict in Ukraine removed, I think I'm right in saying, about 3% of the world's gas. We had power outages. Gas prices went up 500%. Higher prices from energy mean a higher tax, essentially, for the consumers and industry. And coal consumption went up to its highest level in a decade. So the world needs a better and balanced energy system. But society's priority is secure, affordable, available energy. And that needs ongoing investment as well. High level, how do you think we resolve that equation?
High level. I mean, you said it there, and that sometimes the term trilemma is used. It's the security of energy, it's the affordability of energy, and then it's the sustainability of that energy and low carbon energy that the world needs. And what the conflict in Ukraine showed is how fragile that system is. If you take some of the supply out, the acute impact that can have on individuals, families, and countries. And in Europe specifically, Europe had to change tact almost overnight and is now increasing its LNG imports. It has to, in order to meet the gap. And what does that mean? That means the world needs a little bit more gas. And if you look at any profile that's out there now, they're showing an increasing in demand for gas across the decade. And so integrated energy companies need to be prepared to deliver, you know, secure and affordable gas for these countries. Now, in terms of the sustainability and low carbon and the longevity of gas, that will depend on the speed of the transition and how quickly countries can decarbonize. Now, one advantage of renewable energy is it can be locally sourced. I worked for a renewable energy company for 2.5 years, and you build renewable energy for that local infrastructure and that local market. And by securing that energy, you're also securing energy supply. And what we're seeing in the world right now is that increased demand for energy security, local energy security, not only just power generation, but the supply chain that goes around that. And that's what we've seen in the United States, for example, with the IRA, which is not only just incentivizing investment in the energy transition, but it's also incentivizing investment in the supply chain that supports the energy supply.
And when BP writes about resilient hydrocarbons, for us non-geologists and physicists, explain what that means, because this stuff has got more difficult to extract in many in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember when I joined the industry nearly 20 years ago, and at the time it was all the talk around peak oil and when peak oil, when are we going to run out of oil? So there was this race for volume. There was this race to access more and more reserves. I mean, the world is a very, very different place now. And we look at demand and what's the world demanding? And then how can companies be resilient to that? And the hydrocarbon portfolio needs to be resilient, not only to the diversity of supply, but also resilient to different price points. I don't know what the oil price will be next week, next month, next year. I probably wouldn't be sitting here if I did. So we need to make sure that we are disciplined in how we invest in the oil and gas part of our portfolio. So it can be resilient to different price points. It can also be resilient to a cost profile over the longer term. It needs to be resilient to a lower carbon ambition, which we've signed up to. And it needs to be resilient in terms of the technology that's needed to develop and be capitally efficient in order to provide the returns that we and our investors are looking for. So that's what we look for. And, you know, we do have a deep hopper of opportunities. We have around 36 billion barrels, of which 18 billion barrels we have line of sight for already in our plans to develop. And we have quality through choice. And that's ultimately how we can generate those, that resilient hydrocarbon part of our portfolio.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. Earlier this year, I spoke to David Neal, CEO of IFM Investors, who shared the firm's strategy and mission to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of 120 million working people. We're pleased to now be sponsored by IFM Investors, who are owned by pension funds and inspired by their members. They were set up in Australia 30 years ago, and today have a truly global footprint, operating across 11 cities and employing over 600 people. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. They're a responsible and long-term investor too, actively engaging with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, helping to improve performance whilst minimizing risk. Please tap the link in the episode description to learn more. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. So I actually listened to a Shell call on gas last week to try and give myself some semblance of education, and their numbers were that the demand for liquefied natural gas, LNG, is estimated to rise by more than 50% by 2040. Big switches, obviously, in China, Southeast Asia. You are now in charge of Wells, yes, and so must see that the interplay of demand and more difficult supply and all those other issues. Just give us a picture of, you know, what that means to be in charge of Wells.
Well, Wells ultimately is the conduit between the subsurface, the underground, and ultimately the steel that generates the oil and gas into a product that's marketable. So, and what that means for us is that, you know, our activity set needs to be resilient. So we are currently operating around 25 offshore rigs globally. We have around 15 onshore rigs as well. Most of that in the US. We have a couple in Oman. And we're not just drilling for oil. We drill for oil, yes, in some deep water, Gulf of Mexico, North Sea, for example. We're also drilling for gas. So we just started up a rig in Egypt. We started up another rig in Oman. We're also drilling for what we call water injectors. This is where we inject water back into the ground in order to protect the reservoir pressure. We'll also be drilling carbon capture wells. It's the same rigs and the same people and same teams who designed the wells that will capture carbon in the future, for example, the Net Zero Teesside project here in the UK. We will also looking at geothermal. Geothermal is another example of drilling. So our part of the business needs to have all the tools in the toolbox that BP needs to be able to drill offshore deep water, high pressure gas, onshore, tight gas fracking, which is what happens in shale business in the US.
And is there a difference in approach from the US operators to BP and Shell?
We are partners with Shell in the Gulf of Mexico, so we work very, very closely in the deep water. So we are partners on some of their operated fields, and they're partners with us. So we learn a lot from each other. But in addition, in the US, BP has the BPX business, which is the shale business. We have 13 rigs, a mix of gas and oil development. We run that business a little bit differently. It's got its own CEO, and it's able to move at a pace because it's a slightly different risk profile to the offshore. And it's business that we can, you know, switch on and off capital as we need to, depending on the need and the appetite and the returns. So, but that is a business we see growing out until the end of the decade. We expect at least 1 million barrels coming from the United States by 2030, of which around 600,000 should be coming from the BPX business.
Now, you mentioned in passing rigs, but you and I had a call last week and you said, if I understood it correctly, there's a shortage of rigs. What's going on with rigs?
Yeah, rigs have had an interesting, I'd say, 10 or 15 years. If we go back to 2013, rig rates were extremely high, especially offshore, what we call offshore deep water. And it was very, very difficult on operators. Operating costs were very, very high. And then towards the end of that decade, they came down. I mean, this was accelerated by COVID as well and decreasing demand, and rig rates went right down. And many rig companies really struggled. They'd invested a lot in building new rigs and they were no longer getting the rates that they used to get. So many of the rig companies went into Chapter 11, had to financially restructure. And that means that there's just been a lack of investment over the past few years into new rigs coming on the market. So if you look now across the shipyards around the world and look at what we call jack-up rigs, the ones with legs, the percentage of jack-up rigs in shipyards is the lowest it's been in well over 20 years. In terms of floating rigs, we are very, very few in the shipyard. Are there enough rigs in the world for today? I'd say yes, but as each well delivers less and we need to drill more wells, could this be a challenge in the future, potentially?
And that brings me to a different question, which is, you know, there was a headline the other day that Barclays is no longer going to provide finance to the energy industry. And there's a lot of stuff that might be well-intentioned, but as an old-fashioned investor, it strikes me as remarkably sort of short-sighted and playing to the crowd. As finance is withdrawn, does that help or hinder BP?
The energy transition needs financing, however you look at it. And if I go back to the fundamentals of my physics training, you know, we think of three potential scenarios, and the IEA will have their own version, but something like, you know, there's the net zero scenario, there's an accelerated scenario, which assumes, you know, 75% reduction of CO2 by 2050, or there's like a momentum scenario, which is we're doing everything we do today, which will be a 30% reduction. So whichever scenario you look at, we still need oil and gas in that system. We also need carbon capture in that system. We need hydrogen, we need power, we need electrification. And all of this needs financing. And if you pull out a small part of that system, you know, like we saw with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the whole thing can crumble down. And as you said earlier, I think you said that we actually saw higher investment in coal after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I think it's really important that the system works, the financing system works, the financing goes to the right place to support the energy transition. Because ultimately, it's not just IECs who are supplying oil and gas to the world. National oil companies around the world are too. And someone will provide that to that demand. So the choice, and if we've got choice in business, that's a luxury, but the choice is where do you put your investment dollar to support the right system that you think is the one that's the most sustainable over the longer term.
Before we leave gas, there is this discrepancy between natural gas prices in Europe and the US, and approximately European prices are five times higher because it has to be shipped and it doesn't lie on the doorstep. But over time, such price anomalies tend not to persist. I wonder how you view that spread and how you view the gas equation.
What happened a few years ago with the shale gas revolution in the United States was when the United States bought on a bunch of new gas and started exporting that gas, you suddenly had very cheap gas landing in Europe and cheaper gas landing in Asia. And that just changed the climate completely because the appetite for long-term LNG type of contracts, which would typically kind of smooth things out over the years, were no longer there. Companies would prefer to buy spot. So it's, you know, there's a lot of dynamics here. So unlike oil, you know, it's not completely connected on a global level. So you need to have a mix in your portfolio. And if I look at what BP are doing, we have a mix of LNG, we have piped gas, we have lower 48 US gas as well, and we have a world-class trading organization. So I think we have enough mix in our portfolio and resilience to be able to balance across the markets.
So as we think about the transition, Bloomberg New Energy Finance have produced some data that estimated that CapEx investment in clean energy last year was $1.8 trillion, and that was despite, you know, rates up. I think BP is planning on spending by 2030 between $7 and $9 billion on energy transition. Give us a sense of what that means in terms of what are the priorities for BP. And you yourself are going to come on a second with the COO of Lightsource, the solar business. So maybe we can weave that in as well.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, BP's capital frame is around $16 billion per annum. Around roughly half of that goes into the oil and gas business, and the other half goes into everything else, including some of what we call the new energies and growth transitions. How I relate to that, I mean, ultimately, we can think about this in terms of three value chains. We've got the oil value chain, which, of course, we invest in, everything from developing oil through to refining oil products to trading the oil and doing that more sustainably, and lower carbon footprint oil and higher margin oil will drive EBITDA growth. Second value chain is the gas value chain, which will have capital investment. As I mentioned earlier, it's about having diversification of that gas supply and then a world-class trading organization to sell it, and also playing in the LNG markets. And the third value chain, which is the newer value chain, is the low-carbon power value chain. So this is renewable power, which can come from solar or wind, could go into the electricity markets, but also into creating green hydrogen, which we know the demand will increase over time, and also green power into EV charging, which is a big part of our growth for the renewables business. And that value chain is newer. So if you think about the oil value chain, it's probably 100 years old. The gas value chain is about 60 years old. And this value chain is newer for us, you know, last few years. And how you allocate capital across these value chains and growth to feed what should be a growth in EBITDA over time and having the right balance and mix. So from my perspective, sitting in my company, I'm just not sure there are many companies out there who can play across all three value chains and have the scale to do so and do so well. And so that's how I think about it.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Now, you went to Lightsource to be the COO. Tell us about solar. I mean, we all understand that the problem about these other energies is they're intermittent and energy storage at scale is, you know, constrained. Just talk about solar and the challenges and the successes.
You know, Lightsource was a startup company here in London, founded by a gentleman called Nick Boyle, who is still currently the CEO. And they had figured out how to raise the financing to develop solar here in the UK back on what was the feed-in tariff that was here at the time and grow very, very quickly. And they did so very, very successfully, becoming the number one developer of utility-scale solar. And then in 2017, BP invested in that company and then deepened to a 50-50 JV from 2018. Now, what was interesting about this company is if you can make solar work in the UK, then you can probably make it work anywhere else. And the advantage of bringing BP in was the opportunity for international expansion. And part of my remit as COO coming in 2020 was to help help lead that and help put the engine in place that took this company, which was scaling up in its own right, but making it a true international player across, you know, Americas, Europe, and more recently, Asia Pacific. In terms of intermittency, well, as long as the sun is coming up every day, you're going to produce some power. And the way this company worked was we would raise, you know, financing against the projects and then sell the power as part of a what we call a PPA, a power purchase agreement. And that can be to, you know, it can be to big blue chip companies or local companies. And then you secure the financing against that PPA. And then once you've developed your solar plant, you can then hang on to it. We could operate. It's quite a low risk cash generating unit. You could finance it as you wish, or you can flip it. You can sell and then recycle that capital to allow the company to grow. So this model worked in the sense of it allowed Lightsource BP to grow. We were probably, you know, top three developer in the United States. We probably top in Europe, top in Australia, depending what metric you look at, probably top five globally in terms of our ability to develop large scale utility solar. The second thing we did at Lightsource BP was bring in storage. So battery storage that helps with the intermittency point, but also it can help the returns on your project if you're able to put a battery alongside your solar plant and able to finance that and have a customer for that power. That can also boost returns. And I do see that as a growth trend for renewables is the solar plus battery, especially as the markets allow for the monetization of that investment.
One of the, I think, surprising developments around AI is how energy consumptive it is. Could the world be underestimating the demand for energy over the next decade?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there are various scenarios out there, which one of the pieces of data that you need to put in is what does the energy demand look like? And on one angle, you can look at energy efficiency. So actually, AI will help us become more efficient. I'm actually on a board of a company called Powerverse, which looks at using AI for efficiency in the home. But also, Gen AI and data centers need a lot of power. And I think it's something that Murray talks about often when he talks about where's this demand coming from in the future and how as an IEC do we prepare for that demand and what does that look like?
Yeah, I think the data I read was that Schneider, the French electric company, projects that AI-driven power will grow 25 to 30%. And John Malden, who's a very seasoned commentator in the US, I'll quote him, said, energy usage from AI is a massive game changer, not priced into the narrative today. We will look back in years to come and say, how did we miss it?
All this Gen AI needs very energy-hungry data centers to run effectively. So if you're investing in AI, you should probably look at energy as well.
So in fact, related to that, a friend of the show, Tim Chapman, who's an energy corporate financier for years, I was talking to him. He said, companies like BP are at the cutting edge of technology, R&D innovation, measuring, drilling, integrating technologies. His question was, how is technology going to impact BP's energy demand and supply model?
Number one, I think the comment around how we adapt technology and engineering to what we do is very welcomed because it's such a priority area for us. We are an engineering company. We've always been an engineering company and we pride ourselves along that. So we will invest in technology that makes us more efficient. We will invest in technology that makes us be able to drill wells that were undrillable before. We will invest in technology that makes us safer. We'll invest in technology that makes us more sustainable. So that is a key part of our strategy and a key part of how we think about our investment. Secondly, it's the demand side. And I think, you know, data centers and digital is going to need more energy. And how we partner, I would say, in the world with other companies to meet that demand will be very key. And I can see some of these partnerships being mutually beneficial, not only to what we are trying to achieve with technology and AI and more recently Gen AI, which has massive potential, but also how the companies who are producing these products are going to feed, where are they going to get their energy from to produce this? So I think ultimately this could become quite beneficial for both sides.
So it was the great George Soros who reminded us to discount the obvious and expect the unexpected. And I wonder, as you look out a decade plus, how you think the industry may look?
It's a great question, and it's probably one I'll get wrong, because any outlook I've seen has always been wrong. I mean, I mentioned the shale revolution earlier. I mean, that was not in any energy outlook or scenario. Geopolitics has a huge role to play in how the scenarios could come out. The one thing I would say, though, is, and you touched on it as well, is generally we underplay or underestimate the role of innovation in our outlooks and in our scenarios. So that is the question I ask myself when I look at any scenario. Are we modeling this based on what we know today or what we don't know about the future and how that's going to evolve? And are we as prepared as we can be? Because we must be. To be a true IEC, we need to be prepared.
Can you give us a practical example of how AI is already being implemented, you know, in your work?
Absolutely. So I'll start off with, I mean, analytical AI we use today. So analytical AI using a billion data points a day that we get from all our rigs around the world to make the right decisions day to day, minute by minute. When we're drilling wells, we can optimize the direction. A human being just wouldn't be able to process that amount of data in that amount of time. So we can use that data today to help us be more efficient and make better choices. I think as Gen AI comes in, it will be around pulling together just that a wider data set. So let's starting with safety, which is, you know, our number one priority. We can actually use Gen AI to help us have the right safety conversations offshore. So you're starting your day offshore, you're thinking, I'm doing this operation. Gen AI can tell you, based on the activity you're doing, what the weather forecast is, the time of year, the chance of something potentially going wrong. And these are the things that you need to be focusing on. Now, a human being just wouldn't be able to gather all that information together and articulate it in that way. But Gen AI is already showing capability to do that. So we'll be trialing that out in some of our rigs, hopefully this year. And then beyond that, it's how we use Gen AI to run a variety of different scenarios to help us optimize our investment and how we work and help engineers do their job. I'm a big believer that Gen AI is not here to replace human beings. Gen AI is here to be side by side with human beings to make better choices and make better decisions for the company and for the operation. And this is critical as it gets more and more technically challenging to develop our reserves.
So I was saving the trickier questions too as we went along. Now, I was reading some Bernstein research that put a 60% upside onto your stock price, and we know how vulnerable all of these forecasts are, but BP's obviously got these prodigious cash flows, I think, you know, with all your buybacks and your dividends and a balance sheet that's got gearing out 27% or so. I think that BP is on a 13% distribution yield, which is the highest of the majors. Do you think the market understands BP?
Great question. I actually spent some time at Capital Markets Day in October, and our mission, and this starts with us, the communicator, how are we communicating our business fundamentals to the analysts and to our investors? So we spent some time talking about the oil, gas, and the biogas side of our business in Denver in October, just showing what underpins the fundamentals, especially out to the end of the decade. Understanding that we have what our production profile looks like, what our reserves look like, and how we plan on developing them and growing EBITDA. So, I mean, you mentioned earlier our market cap is sitting around 100 billion. I mean, our results last year were around 43, 44 billion EBITDA. We've explained to the market that we have plans to grow that to 46 to 49 billion EBITDA by 2025. And then we can show that momentum also out to the end of the decade. Now, you know, if you look at our multiple, it's pretty low. But so therefore, we just need to show, you know, we've got track record, confidence in the delivery. And that's what my job is to make sure that we deliver our part of the business. We spend capital wisely. We stay safe. We're efficient. And that we can be trusted with the investment and the value that comes our way. And hopefully the communication and the delivery together result in more confidence. And hopefully Bernstein were correct.
Well, before we started the interview, we were chatting because you've kindly listened to a couple of our episodes. You were listening to the Nicolai Tangen one, head of the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. I'm fascinating. And he had actually had an interview with Bernard Looney when he was CEO and talked about why the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund owned, and I may still own, a position in BP. What would you say to shareholders who deem the super majors like BP to be uninvestable?
I mean, every shareholder has a choice, of course. And I would take it back to its fundamentals, is energy demand is here. Energy demand is growing. And the mix is getting more interesting as you go out the decade. And then the choice is where you invest. Yes, you can invest in pure oil and gas players because there's a case. You can invest in pure play renewables. You can invest in convenience. You can invest in other parts of the energy mix. But the truth is, I mean, the mix is going to be there. And there are not many companies who can do that scale and the mix that BP does. So it's a choice.
The other force that's been at work has been more deals, more M&A. We've seen, you know, concentration in pharma, in tobacco, in multiple, in financial services. Is that sort of inevitable?
Well, M&A is happening all the time. I think we're very focused on value. I mean, I feel that it's in our culture. We focus on value in our organic investment and, you know, we focus on value in our inorganic investment as well. And, you know, Murray spoke quite powerfully at this the results call a couple of weeks ago and spoke about, you know, it's better to invest countercyclically and we don't want to be overpaying. And also we're already sitting on, you know, quite a lot of resource that we already have to develop. So there's no pressure for us to do anything big inorganically. We certainly don't feel that internally. We have a lot of high value assets to develop organically.
We talked at the beginning about an industry that had historically had a male dominated industry with a macho culture. How do you attract talent today?
Thank you for that question. And also, we do have an image. I think the industry, especially oil and gas, and I'd say especially drilling, which is the area I lead, you know, has an image of perhaps being quite male-dominated or at worst, macho. One thing I would say is the industry's evolved and moved on a lot. Even in the 20 years I've been, it has moved on drastically. We are, number one, making sure that the image that we have is more representative of what we actually do. So the engineers and the operators and the people working offshore are working on some of the most interesting challenges on this planet. I mean, the amount of capital, that investment that goes in, the technical challenges of what we do, working directly with Mother Nature all around the world, is fascinating. So any curious engineer out there would be very welcomed in the energy sector. We actually need more of them. I think that's number one. Also, our pool is not just UK and US. I mean, we recruit all around the world. We recruit in Azerbaijan, in Egypt, in India. And, you know, we do have, you know, different appetites depending where we are in the world to come into our sector. And it's because of the challenges that the sector faces that attracts young people. And we want more of that to be visible and a more diverse group of people interested in joining and wanting to help solve these challenges. And also, I think if you look towards the future, being people joining our industry today will be right in the thick of it in 2050. And what's that going to look like? If you look at the mix that we'll, you know, we could be 75% electrified by then. What does that world actually look like? What are the challenges that will come through? Who's going to solve those challenges? What are the financing is going to look like? How are our kids and our kids' kids going to access and use energy? Is it going to be more expensive or is it going to be a little bit like data where you just pay for access? So it's absolutely fascinating the way the world is going. And I just can't think of another sector which has as much to offer as the energy industry. So I would encourage anyone who's even slightly interested to check it out. And for women specifically, please don't be put off by images of an offshore macho type of environment. I mean, I've worked offshore. I've spent time offshore. I've only ever been treated with professionalism and respect. And the reward that you get from having a career and living a life that is so unusual and so uncommon will stay with me forever.
Well, I think you said, and it made me think, because you are one of our younger guests, despite your, you know, terrific success to date, is that, you know, you'll be in this industry probably running something in, you know, 20 years or less, but you have longevity. You have a long runway, you know, in this industry.
I hope so.
Very exciting. So a couple of closing questions. I know you're a very fit, athletic person as well. I have to ask you, what are the unclimbed peaks in your life that you want to have conquered, metaphorically?
Metaphorically. Oh, gosh. So I go back to the question you asked me earlier about my childhood and my what I feel like is the infinite curiosity. I think there's so much more to do in our sector. There's so much more to do in our company. I also just want to get closer to the society who we serve. So that means spending more time in the countries that we operate in and really thinking deeper about the role of companies like ours in serving society. And that's why I do what I do. That's why I can be proud to tell my daughters why I work at BP, whether I'm working in solar or oil or gas or carbon capture, because we are building the system that the world so desperately needs. And despite all the comments or the negativity, this is a good thing. And I do believe the world is a better place with energy companies in it than without it.
Got it. And my final question after that book, if you could tell us just one thing in terms of advice for life to anybody listening, young and old, across the world, if you could tell us just one thing.
Stay curious and never be put off by a big mission.
Excellent. Well, we have not covered oil on the Money Myths podcast in 140-ish interviews. I've been looking forward to this because I'm intrigued. I think there are lots of simplistic assumptions that are made by naive politicians amongst them, but not exclusively, you know, the politicians. And there is a reality is that we go home and we need to run our bars and turn on our ovens and lights, and that people like BP and others are at the epicenter of that. So you can wish what you like, but we have to deal with the realities. So probably there's a hint of irritation in my voice about some of those clarion calls for, unrealistic timelines, should we say. But lots of things to take away. Two that particularly stay with me is, it's coming back to this, the extraordinary influence of technology more broadly, AI within it, to be able to make you more efficient along with your, you know, the other companies in the space, but it's a very powerful force, number one. Number two, that this extraordinary intersection of these multiple strands and sources of energy that are going to dictate a hybrid, and we haven't even spoken about nuclear today, and that it's actually a very exciting place to work for young people.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here today. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.